A clock in a window across the street told him that it was 3:12. Well, this was it. He had to go in. He lifted his left hand and wiped sweat from his forehead in a long, slow gesture. He hesitated a moment longer at the door, then went in, walking with firm steps to the rear table. He did not speak to Jack or G.H., nor they to him. He lit a cigarette with shaking fingers and watched the spinning billiard balls roll and gleam and clack over the green stretch of cloth, dropping into holes after bounding to and fro from the rubber cushions. He felt impelled to say something to ease the swelling in his chest. Hurriedly, he flicked his cigarette into a spittoon, and with twin eddies of blue smoke jutting from his black nostrils, shouted hoarsely, "Jack, I bet you 2 bits you can't make it." Jack did not answer. The ball shot straight across the table and vanished into a side pocket.
"You would have lost," Jack said.
"Too late now," Bigger said. "You wouldn't bet, so you lost." He spoke without looking. His entire body hungered for keen sensation, something exciting and violent to relieve the tautness. It was now 3:10, and Gus had not come. If Gus stayed away much longer, it would be too late, and Gus knew that. If they were going to do anything, it certainly ought to be done before folks started coming into the streets to buy their food for supper, and while the cop was down at the other end of the block.
"That bastard," Bigger said. "I knew it."
"Oh, he'll be along," Jack said.
"Sometimes I like to cut his yellow heart out," Bigger said, fingering the knife in his pocket.
"Maybe he's hanging around some meat," G.H. said.
"He's just scared," Bigger said. "Scared to rob a white man."
The billiard balls clacked. Jack chalked his cue stick, and the metallic noise made Bigger grit his teeth until they ached. He didn't like that noise. It made him feel like cutting something with his knife.
"If he makes us miss his job, I'll fix him, so help me," Bigger said. "He oughtn't be late. Every time somebody's late, things go wrong. Look at the big guys. You don't ever hear of them being late, do you? Nah, they work like clocks."
"Ain't none of us got more guts than Gus," G.H. said. "He's been with us every time."
"Oh, shut your trap," Bigger said.
"There you go again, Bigger," G.H. said. "Gus was just talking about how you act this morning. You get too nervous when something's coming off."
"Don't tell me I'm nervous," Bigger said.
"If we don't do it today, we can do it tomorrow," Jack said.
"Tomorrow's Sunday, fool."
"Bigger, for Christ's sakes, don't holler," Jack said tensely.
Bigger looked at Jack hard and long, then turned away with a grimace.
"Don't tell the world what we're trying to do,"
Jack whispered in a mollifying tone. Bigger walked to the front of the store and stood looking out of the plate glass window. Then suddenly, he felt sick. He saw Gus coming along the street, and his muscles stiffened. He was going to do something to Gus. Just what? He did not know. As Gus neared, he heard him whistling, "The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down." The door swung in.
"Hi, Bigger," Gus said.
Bigger did not answer. Gus passed him and started toward the rear tables. Bigger whirled and kicked him hard. Gus flopped on his face with a single movement of his body. With a look that showed that he was looking at Gus on the floor, and at Jack and G.H. at the rear table, and at Doc, looking at them all at once in a kind of smiling, roving, turning slowly glance, Bigger laughed, softly at first, then harder, louder, hysterically. Feeling something like hot water bubbling inside of him and trying to come out. Gus got up and stood, quiet, his mouth open and his eyes dead black with hate.
"Take it easy, boys," Doc said, looking up from behind his counter and then bending over again. "What you kick me for?" Gus asked.
"'Cause I wanted to," Bigger said.
Gus looked at Bigger with lowered eyes. G.H. and Jack leaned on their cue sticks and watched, silently.
I'm going to fix you one of these days, Gus threatened.
Say that again, Bigger said. Doc laughed, straightening and looking at Bigger.
Lay off the boy, Bigger.
Gus turned and walked toward the rear tables. Bigger, with an amazing bound, grabbed him in the back of his collar.
I asked you to say that again.
Quit, Bigger,
Gus spluttered, choking, sinking to his knees.
Don't tell me to quit.
The muscles of his body gave a tightening lunge, and he saw his fist come down on the side of Gus's head. He had struck him, really, before he was conscious of doing so.
Don't hurt him, Jack said.
I'll kill him,
Bigger said through shut teeth, tightening his hold on Gus's collar, choking him harder.
Turn me loose,
Gus gurgled, struggling.
Make me,
Bigger said, drawing his fingers tighter. Gus was very still, resting on his knees. Then, like a taut bow finding release, he sprang to his feet, shaking loose from Bigger and turning to get away. Bigger staggered back against the wall, breathless for a moment. Bigger's hand moved so swiftly that nobody saw it. A gleaming blade flashed. He made a long step, as graceful as an animal leaping, threw out his left foot and tripped Gus to the floor. Gus turned over to rise, but Bigger was on top of him, with the knife open and ready.
Get up. Get up and I'll slice your tonsils.
Gus lay still.
That's all right, Bigger, Gus said in surrender. Let me up.
You trying to make a fool out of me, ain't you?
Nah,
Gus said, his lips scarcely moving.
You goddamn right you ain't,
Bigger said. His face softened a bit, and the hard glint in his bloodshot eyes died. But he still knelt with the open knife. Then he stood.
Get up, he said.
Please, Bigger.
You want me to slice you?
He stooped again and placed the knife at Gus's throat. Gus did not move, and his large black eyes looked pleadingly. Bigger was not satisfied. He felt his muscles tightening again.
Get up. I ain't gonna ask you no more.
Slowly Gus stood. Bigger held the open blade an inch from Gus's lips.
Lick it,
Bigger said, his body tingling with elation. Gus's eyes filled with tears.
Lick it, I said. You think I'm playing?
Gus looked round the room without moving his head, just rolling his eyes in a mute appeal for help. But no one moved. Bigger's left fist was slowly lifting to strike. Gus's lips moved toward the knife. He stuck out his tongue and touched the blade. Gus's lips quivered, and tears streamed on his cheeks. Doc laughed.
Oh, leave him alone, Jack called.
Bigger watched Gus with lips twisted in a crooked smile.
Say, Bigger, ain't you scared him enough?
Doc asked. Bigger did not answer. His eyes gleamed hard again, pregnant with another idea.
Put your hands up, way up, he said.
Gus swallowed and stretched his hands high along the wall.
Leave him alone, Bigger,
G.H. called weakly.
I'm doing this, Bigger said.
He put the tip of the blade into Gus's shirt and then made an arc with his arm as though cutting a circle.
How would you like me to cut your belly button out?
Gus did not answer. Sweat trickled down his temples. His lips hung wide, loose.
Shut them liver lips of yours.
Gus did not move a muscle. Bigger pushed the knife harder into Gus's stomach.
Bigger,
Gus said in a tense whisper.
Shut your mouth.
Gus shut his mouth. Doc laughed. Jack and G.H. laughed. Then Bigger stepped back and looked at Gus with a smile.
You clown, he said. Put your hands down and sit on that chair.
He watched Gus sit.
That ought to teach you not to be late next time, see?
We ain't late, Bigger. We still got time.
Shut up. It is late,
Bigger insisted commandingly. Bigger turned aside. Then, hearing a sharp scrape on the floor, stiffened. Gus sprang from the chair and grabbed a billiard ball from the table and threw it with a half-sob and half-curse. Bigger flung his hands upward to shield his face, and the impact of the ball struck his wrist. He had shut his eyes when he had glimpsed the ball sailing through the air toward him, and when he opened his eyes, Gus was flying through the rear door, and at the same time he heard the ball hit the floor and roll away. A hard pain throbbed in his hand. He sprang forward, cursing.
You son of a bitch!
He slipped on a cue stick lying in the middle of the floor and tumbled forward.
That's enough now, Bigger,
Doc said, laughing. Jack and G.H. also laughed. Bigger rose and faced them, holding his hurt hand. His eyes were red, and he stared with speechless hate.
Just keep laughing, he said. Behave yourself, boy,
Doc said.
Just keep laughing,
Bigger said again, taking out his knife.
Watch what you're doing now,
Doc cautioned.
Aw, Bigger,
Jack said, backing away toward the rear door.
You done spoil things now, G.H. said. I reckon that was what you wanted.
You go to hell,
Bigger shouted, drowning out G.H.'s voice. Doc bent down behind the counter, and when he stood up he had something in his hand which he did not show. He stood there laughing. White spittle showed at the corners of Bigger's lips. He walked to the billiard table, his eyes on Doc. Then he began to cut the green cloth on the table with long, sweeping strokes of his arm. He never took his eyes from Doc's face.
Why, you son of a bitch,
Doc said.
I ought to shoot you, so help me God. Get out before I call a cop.
Bigger walked slowly past Doc, looking at him, not hurrying, and holding the open knife in his hand. He paused in the doorway and looked back. Jack and G.H. were gone.
Get out of here,
Doc said, showing a gun.
Don't you like it? Bigger asked.
Get out before I shoot you,
Doc said.
And don't you ever set your black feet inside here again.
Doc was angry, and Bigger was afraid. He shut the knife and slipped it in his pocket and swung through the door to the street. He blinked his eyes from the bright sunshine. His nerves were so taut that he had difficulty in breathing. Halfway down the block, he passed Blum's store. He looked out of the corners of his eyes, through the plate glass window, and saw that Blum was alone, and the store was empty of customers. Yes, they would have had time to rob the store. In fact, they still had time. He had lied to Gus and G.H. and Jack. He walked on. There was not a policeman in sight. Yes, they could have robbed the store and could have gotten away. He hoped the fight he had had with Gus covered up what he was trying to hide. At least the fight made him feel the equal of them. And he felt the equal of Doc, too. Had he not slashed his table and dared him to use his gun? He had an overwhelming desire to be alone. He walked to the middle of the next block and turned into an alley. He began to laugh softly, tensely. He stopped still in his tracks and felt something warm roll down his cheek, and he brushed it away.
Jesus, he breathed. I laughed so hard I cried.
Carefully, he dried his face on his coat sleeve, then stood for 2 whole minutes staring at the shadow of a telephone pole on the alley pavement. Suddenly, he straightened and walked on with a single expulsion of breath.
What the hell?
He stumbled violently over a tiny crack in the pavement.
God damn,
he said. When he reached the end of the alley, he turned into a street, walking slowly in the sunshine, his hands jammed deep into his pockets, his head down, depressed. He went home and sat in a chair by the window, looking out dreamily.
That you, Bigger?
His mother called from behind the curtain.
Yeah, he said.
What you run in here and run out for a little while ago?
Nothing.
Don't you go and get into no trouble now, boy.
Oh, Ma, leave me alone.
He listened a while to her rubbing clothes on the metal washboard. Then he gazed abstractedly into the street, thinking of how he had felt when he fought Gus in Doc's pool room. He was relieved and glad that in an hour he was going to see about that job at the Dalton place. He was disgusted with the gang. He knew that what had happened today put an end to his being with them in any more jobs. Like a man staring regretfully, but hopelessly, at the stump of a cut-off arm or leg, he knew that the fear of robbing a white man had had hold of him when he started that fight with Gus. But he knew it in a way that kept it from coming to his mind in the form of a hard and sharp idea. His confused emotions had made him feel instinctively that it would be better to fight Gus and spoil the plan of the robbery than to confront a white man with a gun. But he kept this knowledge of his fear thrust firmly down in him. His courage to live depended upon how successfully his fear was hidden from his consciousness. He had fought Gus because Gus was late. That was the reason his emotions accepted, and he did not try to justify himself in his own eyes, or in the eyes of the gang. He did not think enough of them to feel that he had to. He did not consider himself as being responsible to them for what he did, even though they had been involved as deeply as he in the planned robbery. He felt that same way toward everyone. As long as he could remember, he had never been responsible to anyone. The moment a situation became so that it exacted something of him, he rebelled. That was the way he lived. He passed his days trying to defeat or gratify powerful impulses in a world he feared. Outside his window, he saw the sun dying over the rooftops in the western sky, and watched the first shade of dusk fall. Now and then a streetcar ran past. The rusty radiator hissed at the far end of the room. All day long it had been spring-like, but now dark clouds were slowly swallowing the sun. All at once the street lamps came on, and the sky was black and close to the housetops. Inside his shirt, he felt the cold metal of the gun resting against his naked skin. He ought to put it back between the mattresses. No, he would keep it. He would take it with him to the Dalton place. He felt that he would be safer if he took it. He was not planning to use it, and there was nothing in particular that he was afraid of. But there was in him an uneasiness and distrust that made him feel that he ought to have it along. He was going among white people, so he would take his knife and his gun. It would make him feel that he was the equal of them, give him a sense of completeness. Then he thought of a good reason why he should take it. In order to get to the Dalton place, he had to go through a white neighborhood. He had not heard of any Negroes being molested recently, but he felt that it was always possible. Far away, a clock boomed 5 times. He sighed and got up, and yawned and stretched his arms high above his head to loosen the muscles of his body. He got his overcoat, for it was growing cold outdoors, then got his cap. He tiptoed to the door, wanting to slip out without his mother hearing him. Just as he was about to open it, she called,
"Bigger?"
He stopped and frowned.
"Yeah, Ma?"
"You going to see about that job?"
"Yeah."
"Ain't you going to eat?"
"I ain't got time now."
She came to the door, wiping her soapy hands upon an apron.
"Here, take this quarter and buy you something."
"Okay."
"And be careful, son."
He went out and walked south to 46th Street, then eastward. Well, he would see in a few moments if the Daltons for whom he was to work were the ones he had seen and heard about in the movie. But while walking through this quiet and spacious white neighborhood, He did not feel the pull and mystery of the thing as strongly as he had in the movie. The houses he passed were huge. Lights glowed softly in the windows. The streets were empty, save for an occasional car that zoomed past on swift rubber tires. This was a cold and distant world, a world of white secrets carefully guarded. He could feel a pride, a certainty, and a confidence in these streets and houses. He came to Drexel Boulevard and began to look for 4605. When he came to it, he stopped and stood before a high, black, iron picket fence, feeling constricted inside. All he had felt in the movie was gone. Only fear and emptiness filled him now. Would they expect him to come in the front way or back? It was queer that he had not thought of that. God damn. He walked the length of the picket fence in front of the house, seeking for a walk leading to the rear, but there was none. Other than the front gate, there was only a driveway, the entrance to which was securely locked. Suppose a police saw him wandering in a white neighborhood like this. It would be thought that he was trying to rob or rape somebody. He grew angry. Why had he come to take this goddamn job? He could have stayed among his own people and escaped feeling this fear and hate. This was not his world. He had been foolish in thinking that he would have liked it. He stood in the middle of the sidewalk with his jaws clamped tight. He wanted to strike something with his fist. Well, goddamn. There was nothing to do but go in the front way. If he were doing wrong, they could not kill him, at least. All they could do was tell him that he could not get the job. Timidly, he lifted the latch on the gate and walked to the steps. He paused, waiting for someone to challenge him. Nothing happened. Maybe nobody was home. He went to the door and saw a dim light burning in a shaded niche above a doorbell. He pushed it and was startled to hear a soft gong sound within. Maybe he had pushed it too hard. Oh, what the hell? He had to do better than this. He relaxed his taut muscles and stood at ease, waiting. The doorknob turned. The door opened. He saw a white face. It was a woman.
Hello?
Yes'm, he said.
You want to see somebody?
I want to see Mr. Dalton.
Are you the Thomas boy?
Yes'm.
Come in.
He edged through the door slowly, then stopped halfway. The woman was so close to him that he could see a tiny mole at the corner of her mouth. He held his breath. It seemed that there was not room enough for him to pass without actually touching her.
Come on in, the woman said.
Yes'm, he whispered.
He squeezed through and stood uncertainly in a softly lighted hallway.
Follow me, she said.
With cap in hand and shoulders sloped, he followed, walking over a rug so soft and deep that it seemed he was going to fall at each step he took. He went into a dimly lit room.
Take a seat, she said. I'll tell Mr. Dalton that you're here, and he'll be out in a moment.
Yes'm.
He sat and looked up at the woman. She was staring at him, and he looked away in confusion. He was glad when she left.
That old bastard. What's so damn funny about me? I'm just like she is.
He felt that the position in which he was sitting was too awkward, and found that he was on the very edge of the chair. He rose slightly to sit farther back. But when he sat, he sank down so suddenly and deeply that he thought the chair had collapsed under him. He bounded halfway up, in fear. Then, realizing what had happened, he sank distrustfully down again. He looked round the room. It was lit by dim lights glowing from a hidden source. He tried to find them by roving his eyes, but could not. He had not expected anything like this. He had not thought that this world would be so utterly different from his own that it would intimidate him. On the smooth walls were several paintings, whose nature he tried to make out, but failed. He would have liked to examine them, but dared not. Then he listened. A faint sound of piano music floated to him from somewhere. He was sitting in a white home. Dim lights burned round him. Strange objects challenged him, and he was feeling angry and uncomfortable. "All right, come this way." He started at the sound of a man's voice. "Sir?" "Come this way." Misjudging how far back he was sitting in the chair, his first attempt to rise failed, and he slipped back, resting on his side. Grabbing the arms of the chair, he pulled himself upright and found a tall, lean, white-haired man holding a piece of paper in his hand. The man was gazing at him with an amused smile that made him conscious of every square inch of skin on his black body. "Thomas?" the man asked. "Bigger Thomas?"
"Yes, sir," he whispered, not speaking really, but hearing his words roll involuntarily from his lips.
"Come this way."
"Yes, sir."
He followed the man out of the room and down a hall. The man stopped abruptly. Bigger paused, bewildered. Then he saw, coming slowly toward him, a tall, thin, white woman, walking silently, her hands lifted delicately in the air and touching the walls to either side of her. Bigger stepped back to let her pass. Her face and hair were completely white. She seemed to him like a ghost. The man took her arm gently and held her for a moment. Bigger saw that she was old, and her gray eyes looked stony. "Are you all right?" the man asked.
"Yes," she answered.
"Where's Peggy?"
"She's preparing dinner. I'm quite all right, Henry."
The man let go of the woman, and she walked on slowly, the long white fingers of her hands just barely touching the walls. Behind the woman, following at the hem of her dress, was a big white cat, pacing without sound.
"She's blind," Bigger thought in amazement.
"Come on, this way," the man said.
"Yes, sir."
He wondered if the man had seen him staring at the woman. He would have to be careful here. There were so many strange things. He followed the man into a room. "Sit down."
"Yes, sir,"
he said, sitting. "That was Mrs. Dalton," the man said.
"She's blind."
"Yes, sir."
"She has a very deep interest in colored people."
"Yes, sir,"
Bigger whispered. He was conscious of the effort to breathe. He licked his lips and fumbled nervously with his cap.
"Well, I'm Mr. Dalton."
"Yes, sir."
"Do you think you'd like driving a car?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Did you bring the paper?"
"Sir?"
"Didn't the relief give you a note to me?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
He had completely forgotten about the paper. He stood to reach into his vest pocket, and in doing so, dropped his cap. For a moment, his impulses were deadlocked. He did not know if he should pick up his cap and then find the paper, or find the paper and then pick up his cap. He decided to pick up his cap.
"Put your cap here," said Mr. Dalton, indicating a place on his desk.
"Yes, sir."
Then he was stone still. The white cat bounded past him and leaped upon the desk. It sat looking at him with large, placid eyes and mewed plaintively.
"What's the matter, Kate?"
Mr. Dalton asked, stroking the cat's fur and smiling. Mr. Dalton turned back to Bigger.
"Did you find it?"
"No, sir, but I got it here somewhere."
He hated himself at that moment.
Why was he acting and feeling this way? He wanted to wave his hand and blot out the white man who was making him feel this. If not that, he wanted to blot himself out. He had not raised his eyes to the level of Mr. Dalton's face once since he had been in the house. He stood with his knees slightly bent, his lips partly open, his shoulders stooped, and his eyes held a look that went only to the surface of things. There was an organic conviction in him that this was the way white folks wanted him to be when in their presence. None had ever told him that in so many words, but their manner had made him feel that they did. He laid the cap down, noticing that Mr. Dalton was watching him closely. Maybe he was not acting right. God damn. Clumsily, he searched for the paper. He could not find it at first, and he felt called upon to say something for taking so long.
I had it right here in my vest pocket, he mumbled.
Take your time.
Oh, here it is.
He drew the paper forth. It was crumpled and soiled. Nervously, he straightened it out and handed it to Mr. Dalton, holding it by its very tip end. All right now, said Mr. Dalton. Let's see what you've got here. You live at 3721 Indiana Avenue.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Dalton paused, frowned, and looked up at the ceiling.
What kind of a building is that over there? You mean where I live, sir?
Yes.
Oh, it's just an old building.
Where do you pay rent?
Down on 31st Street.
To the Southside Real Estate Company?
Yes, sir.
Bigger wondered what all these questions could mean. He had heard that Mr. Dalton owned the Southside Real Estate Company, but he was not sure.
How much rent do you pay? $8 a week.
For how many rooms?
We just got one, sir.
I see. Now, Bigger, tell me, how old are you?
I'm 20, sir.
Married?
No, sir.
Sit down, you needn't stand, and I won't be long.
Yes, sir.
He sat. The white cat still contemplated him with large, moist eyes. Now, you have a mother, a brother, and a sister.
Yes, sir.
There are four of you.
Yes, sir, there's four of us,
he stammered, trying to show that he was not as stupid as he might appear. He felt a need to speak more, for he felt that maybe Mr. Dalton expected it. And he suddenly remembered the many times his mother had told him not to look at the floor when talking with white folks or asking for a job. He lifted his eyes and saw Mr. Dalton watching him closely. He dropped his eyes again. They call you Bigger?
Yes, sir.
Now, Bigger, I'd like to talk with you a little.
Yes, goddammit.
He knew what was coming. He would be asked about the time he had been accused of stealing auto tires and had been sent to the reform school. He felt guilty, condemned. He should not have come here. The relief people said some funny things about you. I'd like to talk to you about them. Now, you needn't feel ashamed with me, said Mr. Dalton, smiling. I was a boy myself once, and I think I know how things are, so just be yourself. Mr. Dalton pulled out a package of cigarettes. Here, have one.
No, sir. Thank you, sir.
You don't smoke?
Yes, sir. But I just don't want one now.
Now, Bigger, the relief people said you were a very good worker when you were interested in what you were doing. Is that true?
Well, I do my work, sir.
But they said you were always in trouble. How do you explain that?
I don't know, sir.
Why did they send you to the reform school? His eyes glared at the floor.
They said I was stealing, he blurted out defensively. But I wasn't.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir.
Well, how did you get mixed up in it?
I was with some boys and the police picked us up.
Mr. Dalton said nothing. Bigger heard a clock ticking somewhere behind him, and he had a foolish impulse to look at it, but he restrained himself.
Well, Bigger, how do you feel about it now?
Sir? About what?
If you had a job, would you steal now?
Oh, no, sir. I don't steal.
Well, said Mr. Dalton, they say you can drive a car, and I'm going to give you a job.
He said nothing.
You think you can handle it?
Oh, yes, sir.
The pay calls for $20 a week, but I'm going to give you $25. The extra $5 is for yourself, for you to spend as you like. You will get the clothes you need and your meals. You are to sleep in the back room above the kitchen. You can give the $20 to your mother to keep your brother and sister in school. How does that sound?
It sounds all right, yes, sir.
I think we'll get along.
Yes, sir.
I don't think we'll have any trouble.
No, sir.
Now, Bigger, said Mr. Dalton, since that's settled, let's see what you'll have to do every day. I leave every morning for my office at 9. It's a 20-minute drive. You are to be back at 10 and take Miss Dalton to school. At 12, you call for Miss Dalton at the university. From then until night, you are more or less free. If either Miss Dalton or I go out at night, of course, you do the driving. You work every day, but we don't get up till noon on Sundays, so you will have Sunday mornings to yourself, unless something unexpected happens. You get one full day off every 2 weeks.
Yes, sir.
You think you can handle that?
Oh, yes, sir.
And any time you're bothered about anything, come and see me. Let's talk it over.
Yes, sir.
Oh, Father?
A girl's voice sang out.
Yes, Mary, said Mr. Dalton.
Bigger turned and saw a white girl walk into the room. She was very slender.
Oh, I didn't know you were busy.
That's all right, Mary. What is it?
Bigger saw that the girl was looking at him. Yes. She was the same girl he had seen in the movie.
Is this the new chauffeur, Father?
What do you want, Mary?
Will you get the tickets for the Thursday concert?
At Orchestra Hall?
Yes.
Yes, I'll get them.
Is this the new chauffeur?
Yes, said Mr. Dalton. This is Bigger Thomas.
Hello, Bigger,
the girl said. Bigger swallowed. He looked at Mr. Dalton, then felt that he should not have looked.
Good evening, ma'am.
The girl came close to him and stopped just opposite his chair.
Bigger, do you belong to a union? She asked.
Now, Mary, said Mr. Dalton, frowning.
Well, Father, he should,
the girl said, turning to him, then back to Bigger.
Do you?
Mary,
said Mr. Dalton.
I'm just asking him a question, Father.
Bigger hesitated. He hated the girl then. Why did she have to do this when he was trying to get a job?
No'm,
he mumbled, his head down and his eyes glowering.
And why not?
The girl asked. Bigger heard Mr. Dalton mumble something. He wished Mr. Dalton would speak and end this thing. He looked up and saw Mr. Dalton staring at the girl.
She's making me lose my job, he thought. God damn.
He knew nothing about unions, except that they were considered bad. And what did she mean by talking to him this way in front of Mr. Dalton, who surely didn't like unions?
We can settle about the union later, Mary, said Mr. Dalton.
But you wouldn't mind belonging to a union, would you? The girl asked.
I don't know, ma'am, Bigger said.
Now, Mary, you can see that the boy is new, said Mr. Dalton. Leave him alone. The girl turned and poked out a red tongue at him.
All right, Mr. Capitalist.
She turned again to Bigger.
Isn't he a capitalist, Bigger?
Bigger looked at the floor and did not answer. He did not know what a capitalist was. The girl started to leave, but stopped.
Oh, Father, if he hasn't anything else to do, let him drive me to my lecture at the university tonight.
I'm talking to him now, Mary. He'll be through in a moment.
The girl picked up the cat and walked from the room. There was a short interval of silence. Bigger wished the girl had not said anything about unions. Maybe he would not be hired now. Or, if hired, maybe he would be fired soon if she kept acting like that. He had never seen anyone like her before. She was not a bit the way he had imagined she would be.
Oh, Mary! Mr. Dalton called.
Yes, Father?
Bigger heard her answer from the hallway. Mr. Dalton rose and left the room. He sat still, listening. Once or twice, he thought he heard the girl laugh, but he was not sure. The best thing he could do was to leave that crazy girl alone. No wonder they called her a communist in the movies. She was crazy, all right. He had heard about unions. In his mind, unions and communists were linked. He relaxed a little, then stiffened when he heard Mr. Dalton walk back into the room. Wordlessly, the white man sat behind the desk and picked up the paper and looked at it in a long silence. Bigger watched him with lowered eyes. He knew that Mr. Dalton was thinking of something other than that paper. In his heart, he cursed that crazy girl. Maybe Mr. Dalton was deciding not to hire him. God damn. Maybe he would not get the extra $5 a week now. God damn that woman. She spoiled everything. Maybe Mr. Dalton would feel that he could not trust him.
Oh, Bigger, said Mr. Dalton.
Yes, sir.
I want you to know why I'm hiring you.
Yes, sir.
You see, Bigger, I'm a supporter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Did you ever hear of that organization?
No, sir.
Well, it doesn't matter, said Mr. Dalton. Have you had your dinner?
No, sir.
Well, I think you'll do. Mr. Dalton pushed a button. There was silence. The woman who had answered the front door came in.
Yes, Mr. Dalton.
Peggy, this is Bigger. He's going to drive for us. Give him something to eat and show him where he's to sleep and where the car is.
Yes, Mr. Dalton.
And Bigger, at 8:30, drive Miss Dalton out to the university and wait for her, said Mr. Dalton.
Yes, sir.
That's all now.
Yes, sir.
Come with me,
Peggy said. Bigger rose and got his cap and followed the woman through the house to the kitchen. The air was full of the scent of food cooking, and pots bubbled on the stove.
Sit here, Peggy said, clearing a place for him at a white-topped table.
He sat and rested his cap on his knees. He felt a little better now that he was out of the front part of the house, but still not quite comfortable.
Dinner isn't quite ready yet, Peggy said. You like bacon and eggs?
Yes'm.
Coffee?
Yes'm.
He sat looking at the white walls of the kitchen
and heard the woman stir about behind him.
Did Mr. Dalton tell you about the furnace?
No.
Well, he must have forgotten it. You're supposed to attend to that, too. I'll show you where it is before you go.
You mean I got to keep the fire going, ma'am?
Yes, but it's easy. Did you ever fire before?
No.
You can learn. There's nothing to it.
Yes'm.
Peggy seemed kind enough, but maybe she was being kind in order to shove her part of the work on him. Well, he would wait and see. If she got nasty, he would talk to Mr. Dalton about her. He smelt the odor of frying bacon and realized that he was very hungry. He had forgotten to buy a sandwich with the quarter his mother had given him, and he had not eaten since morning. Peggy placed a plate, knife, fork, spoon, sugar, cream, and bread before him. Then she dished up the bacon and eggs.
You can get more if you want it.
The food was good. This was not going to be a bad job. The only thing bad so far was that crazy girl. He chewed his bacon and eggs while some remote part of his mind considered in amazement how different the girl had seemed in the movie. On the screen, she was not dangerous, and his mind could do with her as it liked. But here in her house, she walked over everything, put herself in the way. He had quite forgotten that Peggy was in the kitchen, and when his plate was empty, he took a soft piece of bread and began to sop it clean, carrying the bread to his mouth in huge chunks.
You want some more?
He stopped chewing and laid the bread aside. He had not wanted to let her see him do that. He did that only at home.
No'm, he said. I got a plenty.
You reckon you'll like it here? Peggy asked.
Yes'm, I hope so.
This is a swell place, Peggy said. About as good as you'll find anywhere. The last colored man who worked for us stayed 10 years.
Bigger wondered why she said us. She must stand in with the old man and old woman pretty good, he thought.
10 years? He said.
Yes, 10 years. His name was Green. He was a good man, too.
How come he to leave?
Oh, he was smart, that Green was. He took a job with the government. Mrs. Dalton made him go to night school. Mrs. Dalton's always trying to help somebody.
Yes, Bigger knew that. But he was not going to any night school. He looked at Peggy. She was bent over the sink washing dishes. Her words had challenged him, and he felt he had to say something.
Yes'm, he was smart, he said. 10 years is a long time.
Oh, it wasn't so long, Peggy said. I've been here 20 years myself. I always was one for sticking to a job. I always say, when you get a good place, then stick there. A rolling stone gathers no moss, and it's true.
Bigger said nothing.
Everything's simple and nice around here, Peggy said. They've got millions, but they live like human beings. They don't put on airs and strut. Mrs. Dalton believes that people should be that way.
Yes'm.
They're Christian people and believe in everybody working hard and living a clean life. Some people think we ought to have more servants than we do, but we get along. It's just like one big family.
Yes'm.
Mr. Dalton's a fine man, Peggy said.
Oh, yes'm, he is.
You know, he does a lot for your people.
My people? Asked Bigger, puzzled.
Yes, the colored people. He gave over $5 million to colored schools.
Oh.
But Mrs. Dalton's the one who's really nice. If it wasn't for her, he would not be doing what he does. She made him rich. She had millions when he married her. Of course, he made a lot of money himself afterwards out of real estate. But most of the money's hers. She's blind, poor thing. She lost her sight 10 years ago. Did you see her yet?
Yes'm.
Was she alone?
Yes'm.
Poor thing. Mrs. Patterson, who takes care of her, is away for the weekend, and she's all alone. Isn't it too bad about her?
Oh, yes'm, he said, trying to get into his voice some of the pity for Mrs. Dalton that he thought Peggy expected him to feel.
It's really more than a job you've got here, Peggy went on. It's just like home. I'm always telling Mrs. Dalton that this is the only home I'll ever know. I wasn't in this country but 2 years before I started working here.
Oh, said Bigger, looking at her.
I'm Irish, you know, she said. My folks in the old country feel about England like the colored folks feel about this country. So I know something about colored people. Oh, these are fine people, fine as silk. Even the girl. Did you meet her yet?
Yes'm.
Tonight?
Yes'm.
Peggy turned and looked at him sharply.
She's a sweet thing, she said. I've known her since she was 2 years old. But she's kind of wild, she is. Always in hot water. Keeps her folks worried. The Lord only knows where she got her wild ways. But she's got 'em. If you stay around here long, you'll get to know her.
Bigger wanted to ask about the girl, but thought that he had better not do that now.
If you're through, I'll show you the furnace in the car and where your room is, she said,
and turned the fire low under the pots on the stove.
Yes'm.
He rose and followed her out of the kitchen, down a narrow stairway at the end of which was the basement. It was dark. Bigger heard a sharp click and the light came on.
This way. What did you say your name was?
Bigger, ma'am.
What?
Bigger.
He smelt the scent of coal and ashes and heard fire roaring. He saw a red bed of embers glowing in the furnace.
This is the furnace, she said.
Yes'm.
Every morning you'll find the garbage here. You burn it and put the bucket on the dumb waiter.
Yes'm.
You never have to use a shovel for coal. It's a self-feeder. Look, see?
Peggy pulled a lever, and there came a loud rattle of fine lumps of coal sliding down a metal chute. Bigger stooped and saw through the cracks of the furnace the coal spreading out fanwise over the red bed of fire.
That's fine, he mumbled in admiration.
And you don't have to worry about water, either. It fills itself.
Bigger liked that. It was easy. It would be fun, almost.
Your biggest trouble will be taking out the ashes and sweeping. And keep track of how the coal runs. When it's low, tell me you're Mr. Dalton and we'll order some more.
Yes'm. I can handle him.
Now, to get to your room, all you have to do is go up these back stairs. Come on.
He followed up a stretch of stairs. She opened a door and switched on a light, and Bigger saw a large room whose walls were covered with pictures of girls' faces and prize fighters.
This was Green's room. He was always one for pictures, but he kept things neat and nice. It's plenty warm here. Oh, yes, before I forget. Here are the keys to the room and the garage and the car. Now I'll show you the garage. You have to get to it from the outside.
He followed her down the steps and outside into the driveway. It was much warmer.
Looks like snow, Peggy said.
Yes'm.
This is the garage, she said,
unlocking and pushing open a door which, as it swung, made lights come on automatically.
You always bring the car out and wait at the side door for the folks. Let's see. You say you're driving Miss Dalton tonight?
Yes'm.
Well, she leaves at 8:30, so you're free until then. You can look over your room if you want to.
Yes'm. I reckon I will.
Bigger went behind Peggy down the stairs and back into the basement. She went to the kitchen, and he went to his room. He stood in the middle of the floor, looking at the walls. There were pictures of Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, Jack Dempsey, and Henry Armstrong.
There were others of Ginger Rogers, Jean Harlow, and Janet Gaynor. The room was large and had two radiators. He felt the bed. It was soft.
Gee.
He would bring Bessie here some night. Not right at once. He would wait until he had learned the ropes of the place. A room all to himself. He could bring a pint of liquor up here and drink it in peace. He would not have to slip around anymore. He would not have to sleep with Buddy and stand Buddy's kicking all night long. He lit a cigarette and stretched himself full length upon the bed.
Oh.
This was not going to be bad at all. He looked at his dollar watch. It was 7. In a little while he would go down and examine the car. And he would buy himself another watch, too. A dollar watch was not good enough for a job like this. He would buy a gold one. There were a lot of new things he would get.
Oh, boy.
This would be an easy life. Everything was all right. Except that girl. She worried him. She might cause him to lose his job if she kept talking about unions. She was a funny girl, all right. Never in his life had he met anyone like her. She puzzled him. She was rich, but she didn't act like she was rich. She acted like... Well, he didn't know exactly what she did act like. In all of the white women he had met, mostly on jobs and at relief stations, there was always a certain coldness and reserve. They stood their distance and spoke to him from afar. But this girl waded right in and hit him between the eyes with her words and ways.
Aw, hell.
What good was there in thinking about her like this? Maybe she was all right. Maybe he would just have to get used to her. That was all. I bet she spends plenty of dough, he thought. And the old man had given $5 million to colored people. If a man could give $5 million away, then millions must be as common to him as nickels. He rose up and sat on the edge of the bed. What make of car was he to drive? He had not thought to look when Peggy had opened the garage door. He hoped it would be a Packard, or a Lincoln, or a Rolls Royce.
Boy, would he drive. Just wait.
Of course, he would be careful when he was driving Miss or Mr. Dalton. But when he was alone, he would burn up the pavement. He would make those tires smoke. He licked his lips. He was thirsty. He looked at his watch. It was 8:10. He would go to the kitchen and get a drink of water and then drive the car out of the garage. He went down the steps, through the basement to the stairs leading to the kitchen door. Though he did not know it, he walked on tiptoe. He eased the door open and peered in. What he saw made him suck his breath in. Mrs. Dalton, in flowing white clothes, was standing stone still in the middle of the kitchen floor. There was silence, save for the slow ticking of a large clock on a white wall. For a moment, he did not know if he should go in or go back down the steps. His thirst was gone. Mrs. Dalton's face was held in an attitude of intense listening, and her hands were hanging loosely at her sides. To Bigger, her face seemed to be capable of hearing in every pore of the skin and listening always to some low voice speaking. Sitting quietly on the floor beside her was the white cat, its large black eyes fastened upon him. It made him uneasy just to look at her and that white cat. He was about to close the door and tiptoe softly back down the stairs when she spoke.
Are you the new boy?
Yes'm.
Did you want something?
I didn't mean to disturb you, ma'am. I just wanted a drink of water.
Well, come on in. I think you'll find a glass somewhere.
He went to the sink, watching her as he walked, feeling that she could see him even though he knew that she was blind. His skin tingled. He took a glass from a narrow shelf and filled it from a faucet. As he drank, He stole a glance at her over the rim of the glass. Her face was still, tilted, waiting. It reminded him of a dead man's face he had once seen. Then he realized that Mrs. Dalton had turned and listened to the sound of his feet as he had walked. "She knows exactly where I'm standing," he thought.
"You like your room?"
she asked. And as she spoke, he realized that she had been standing there waiting to hear the sound of his glass as it had clinked on the sink.
"Oh, yes'm." "I hope you're a careful driver."
"Oh, yes'm, I'll be careful."
"Did you ever drive before?"
"Yes'm, but it was a grocery truck."
He had the feeling that talking to a blind person was like talking to someone whom he himself could scarcely see.
"How far did you go in school, Bigger?"
"To the 8th grade, ma'am."
"Do you ever think of going back?"
"Well, I gotta work now, ma'am."
"Suppose you had the chance to go back?"
"Well, I don't know, ma'am."
"The last man who worked here went to night school and got an education."
"Yes'm."
"What would you want to be if you had an education?"
"I don't know, ma'am."
"Did you ever think about it?"
"No'm."
"Would you rather work?"
"I reckon I would, ma'am."
"Well, we'll talk about that some other time. I think you'd better get the car for Miss Dalton now."
"Yes'm."
He left her standing in the middle of the kitchen floor, exactly as he had found her. He did not know just how to take her. She made him feel that she would judge all he did harshly, but kindly. He had a feeling toward her that was akin to that which he held toward his mother. The difference in his feelings toward Mrs. Dalton and his mother was that he felt that his mother wanted him to do the things she wanted him to do, and he felt that Mrs. Dalton wanted him to do the things she felt that he should have wanted to do. But he did not want to go to night school. Night school was all right, but he had other plans. Well, he didn't know just what they were right now, but he was working them out. The night air had grown warmer. A wind had risen. He lit a cigarette and unlocked the garage. The door swung in, and again he was surprised and pleased to see the lights spring on automatically.
"These people's got everything," he mused.
He examined the car. It was a dark blue Buick with steel spoke wheels and of a new make. He stepped back from it and looked it over. Then he opened the door and looked at the dashboard. He was a little disappointed that the car was not so expensive as he had hoped, but what it lacked in price was more than made up for in color and style.
"It's all right,"
he said half aloud. He got in and backed it into the driveway and turned it round and pulled it up to the side door.
"Is that you, Bigger?"
The girl stood on the steps.
"Yes'm."
He got out and held the rear door open for her.
"Thank you."
He touched his cap and wondered if it were the right thing to do.
"Is that university school out there on the midway, ma'am?"
Through the rear mirror above him, he saw her hesitate before answering.
"Yes, that's the one."
He pulled the car into the street and headed south, driving about 35 miles an hour. He handled the car expertly, picking up speed at the beginning of each block and slowing slightly as he approached each street intersection.
"You drive well," she said.
"Yes'm,"
he said proudly. He watched her through the rear mirror as he drove. She was kind of pretty, but very little. She looked like a doll in a show window. Black eyes, white face, red lips. And she was not acting at all now as she had acted when he first saw her. In fact, she had a remote look in her eyes.
He stopped the car at 47th Street for a red light. He did not have to stop again until he reached 51st Street, where a long line of cars formed in front of him and a long line in back. He held the steering wheel lightly, waiting for the line to move forward. He had a keen sense of power when driving. The feel of a car added something to him. He loved to press his foot against a pedal and sail along, watching others stand still, seeing the asphalt road unwind under him. The lights flashed from red to green, and he nosed the car forward.
Bigger!
Yes'm?
Turn at this corner and pull up on a side street.
Here, ma'am?
Yes, here.
Now what on earth did this mean? He pulled the car off Cottage Grove Avenue and drew to a curb. He turned to look at her, and was startled to see that she was sitting on the sheer edge of the back seat, her face some 6 inches from his.
I scare you?
She asked softly, smiling.
Oh, no,
he mumbled, bewildered. He watched her through the mirror. Her tiny white hands dangled over the back of the front seat, and her eyes looked out vacantly.
I don't know how to say what I'm going to say, she said.
He said nothing. There was a long silence.
This ends Disc 2. Native Son, Disc 3.
What in all hell did this girl want? A streetcar rumbled by. Behind him, reflected in the rear mirror, he saw the traffic lights flash from green to red, and back again. Well, whatever she was going to say, he wished she would say it and get it over. This girl was strange. She did the unexpected every minute. He waited for her to speak. She took her hands from the back of the front seat and fumbled in her purse.
Got a match?
Yes'm.
He dug a match from his vest pocket.
Strike it, she said.
He blinked. He struck the match and held the flame for her. She smoked a while in silence.
You're not a tattletale, are you?
She asked with a smile. He opened his mouth to reply, but no words came. What she had asked and the tone of voice in which she had asked it made him feel that he ought to have answered in some way. But what?
I'm not going to the university, she said at last. But you can forget that. I want you to drive me to the Loop. But if anyone should ask you, then I went to the university. See, Bigger?
Yes'm. It's all right with me, he mumbled.
I think I can trust you.
Yes'm.
After all, I'm on your side.
Now what did that mean? She was on his side. What side was he on? Did she mean that she liked colored people? Well, he had heard that about her whole family. Was she really crazy? How much did her folks know of how she acted? But if she were really crazy, why did Mr. Dalton let him drive her out?
I'm going to meet a friend of mine, who's also a friend of yours, she said.
Friend of mine?
He could not help exclaiming.
Oh, you don't know him yet, she said, laughing.
Oh.
Go to the outer drive, and then to 16 Lake Street.
Yes'm.
Maybe she was talking about the Reds. That was it. But none of his friends were Reds. What was all this? If Mr. Dalton should ask him if he had taken her to the university, he would have to say yes, and depend upon her to back him up. But suppose Mr. Dalton had someone watching, someone who would tell where he had really taken her. He had heard that many rich people had detectives working for them. If only he knew what this was all about, he would feel much better. And she had said that she was going to meet someone who was a friend of his. He didn't want to meet any communists. They didn't have any money.
He felt that it was all right for a man to go to jail for robbery, but to go to jail for fooling around with Reds was bunk. Well, he would drive her. That was what he had been hired for. But he was going to watch his step in this business. The only thing he hoped was that she would not make him lose his job. He pulled the car off the outer drive at 7th Street, drove north on Michigan Boulevard to Lake Street, then headed west for two blocks, looking for number 16.
It's right here, Bigger.
Yes'm. He pulled to a stop in front of a dark building.
Wait, she said, getting out of the car.
He saw her smiling broadly at him, almost laughing. He felt that she knew every feeling and thought he had at that moment, and he turned his head away in confusion. God damn that woman.
I won't be long, she said.
She started off, then turned back.
Take it easy, Bigger. You'll understand it better by and by.
Yes'm, he said, trying to smile, but couldn't.
Isn't there a song like that? A song your people sing?
Like what, ma'am?
We'll understand it better by and by?
Oh, yes'm. She was an odd girl, all right. He felt something in her over and above the fear she inspired in him. She responded to him as if he were human, as if he lived in the same world as she, and he had never felt that before in a white person. But why? Was this some kind of game? The guarded feeling of freedom he had while listening to her was tangled with the hard fact that she was white and rich, a part of the world of people who told him what he could and could not do. He looked at the building into which she had gone. It was old and unpainted. There were no lights in the windows or doorway. Maybe she was meeting her sweetheart. If that was all, then things would straighten out. But if she had gone to meet those communists... And what were communists like, anyway? Was she one? What made people communists? He remembered seeing many cartoons of communists in newspapers, and always they had flaming torches in their hands, and wore beards, and were trying to commit murder or set things on fire. People who acted that way were crazy. All he could recall having heard about communists was associated in his mind with darkness, old houses, people speaking in whispers, and trade unions on strike. And this was something like it. He stiffened. The door into which she had gone opened. She came out, followed by a young white man. They walked to the car, but instead of getting into the back seat, they came to the side of the car and stood, facing him. At once, Bigger recognized the man as the one he had seen in the newsreel in the movie.
Oh, Bigger, this is Jan. And Jan, this is Bigger Thomas.
Jan smiled broadly, then extended an open palm toward him. Bigger's entire body tightened with suspense and dread.
How are you, Bigger?
Bigger's right hand gripped the steering wheel, and he wondered if he ought to shake hands with this white man.
I'm fine, he mumbled.
Jan's hand was still extended. Bigger's right hand raised itself about 3 inches, then stopped in midair.
Come on and shake, Jan said.
Bigger extended a limp palm, his mouth open in astonishment. He felt Jan's fingers tighten about his own. He tried to pull his hand away, ever so gently, but Jan held on, firmly, smiling.
We may as well get to know each other, Jan said. I'm a friend of Mary's.
Yes, sir, he mumbled.
First of all,
Jan continued, putting his foot upon the running board,
don't say sir to me. I'll call you Bigger, and you'll call me Jan. That's the way it'll be between us. How's that?
Bigger did not answer. Mary was smiling. Jan still gripped his hand, and Bigger held his head at an oblique angle, so that he could, by merely shifting his eyes, look at Jan, and then out into the street whenever he did not wish to meet Jan's gaze. He heard Mary laughing softly.
"It's all right, Bigger," she said. "Jan means it."
He flushed warm with anger.
God damn her soul to hell.
Was she laughing at him? Were they making fun of him? What was it that they wanted? Why didn't they leave him alone? He was not bothering them. Yes, anything could happen with people like these. His entire mind and body were painfully concentrated into a single sharp point of attention. He was trying desperately to understand. He felt foolish sitting behind the steering wheel like this, and letting a white man hold his hand. What would people passing along the street think? He was very conscious of his black skin, and there was in him a prodding conviction that Jan, and men like him, had made it so that he would be conscious of that black skin. Did not white people despise a black skin? Then why was Jan doing this? Why was Mary standing there so eagerly, with shining eyes? What could they get out of this? Maybe they did not despise him, but they made him feel his black skin by just standing there looking at him, one holding his hand and the other smiling. He felt he had no physical existence at all right then. He was something he hated, the badge of shame which he knew was attached to a black skin. It was a shadowy region, a no-man's land, the ground that separated the white world from the black that he stood upon. He felt naked, transparent. He felt that this white man, having helped to put him down, having helped to deform him, held him up now to look at him and be amused. At that moment, he felt toward Mary and Jan a dumb, cold, and inarticulate hate.
"Let me drive a while,"
Jan said, letting go of his hand and opening the door. Bigger looked at Mary. She came forward and touched his arm.
"It's all right, Bigger," she said.
He turned in the seat to get out, but Jan stopped him.
"No, stay in and move over."
He slid over, and Jan took his place at the wheel.